everyone. I'm Henrik. Thank you for tuning in to Red Ice Radio. I hope you're doing well today. We're almost at the end of February now, and I can't wait for the Earth to rotate a bit more, getting us closer towards spring and some warmer weather. I'm sure you feel the same. Well, as you know, if you're a regular listener, we cover a wide range of topics on the show with primary focus on finding the truth and exposing lies, detailing the mythologization of our history and how it's being used against us in order to justify how the political system, the media, and the control apparatus is being run in order to better control us. Well, today we are going to enter into one of those sensitive areas where we must go, I believe, if we are to understand the world and why things are the way they are. We've spoken a lot about World War II in the recent year, but we've not really addressed directly and in more detail the story of the extermination camps, concentration camps, and gas chambers. What I find the most intriguing about this whole thing is the treatment of those people who have shown an interest in establishing the proof for the claims made against the National Socialists during the Second World War in order to better understand the situation and figure out what really happened. Truth fears no investigation, right? Well, it seems that it does. Or it's simply that it's not about the truth, it's about something else. When we have people being hounded, pounded, and put in the slammer for looking closer at the details, not even denying it, but just looking at this material, you know that something is terribly wrong. In the European nations that just over a month ago now banded together like nothing else in order to protect our precious freedom of speech after the Charlie Hebdo attacks and also more recently in Copenhagen. But they have, of course, most embarrassingly dropped the ball on this issue. And just yesterday, in fact, the former German lawyer Sylvia Stoltz was jailed again for 20 months just for talking about this issue. We have that article up on redicecreations.com if you want to see that video for yourself and make up your own mind about that. But so what is it all worth, free speech, if this is how some are treated who are not in line with everyone else? These are the true thought criminals of our times. How many who believe in something have really looked deeper into the questions for themselves? Unfortunately, I don't think too many have. They base their reality on popular belief, a fallacy. Argentum ad populum, appeal to the people, or appeal to popularity. It's a fallacious argument that concludes that a proposition is true because many or most people believe it. If many believe so, it is so. Well, unfortunately, or perhaps thankfully, reality does not care about what the majority think is true. It is only concerned with what really is true. And I, for one, would like to know what is true, because on this matter, I don't know. I have questions. We are going to hear more from our guest here in a little bit, but I just wanted to mention a few more things here before we continue. And some of you might not need to hear it, but others will, I think. I do think it's important that we put our emotions to the side when we do these kinds of inquiries. For most time, we should put them to the side. But since there is so much pre-programmed charged emotion that lies behind it, the fundamental question is, are you interested in the truth? Or are you fine living a lie? Ask yourself that. And if you're fine with the latter, then I don't have much more to say to you and you can turn off this program. And you're, of course, free to live as you please, but don't go after people for asking questions that you've never bothered to ask or make accusations against those people. But if you are in that first category, however, if you care about the truth, then I think it's extremely important that you honor that and decide to do something that you haven't done in your life before, which is not only to listen to our guest here today in our program, but look into the other side of the argument about this matter and do the research for yourself. Come to a conclusion on your own if this is a subject that interests you. There is just so much material out there today that most people will never ever will see or look at or read, and I think it's worth to find out for oneself in order to navigate our way in this life, since this issue is a big part of our modern culture, and we are told all the time, in Europe at least, about how guilty we should feel about this, that we didn't do more to stop it. There has also been a banning of views and political parties as a consequence of this. So if these are the charges, then I most definitely would like to know more about them, and if they indeed are true. Searching for the truth shouldn't be a crime, but unfortunately, on this subject, it is, for those who speak about it, that is. Now, I can't say either way. Personally, I invite people to the program to speak, and their words will have to remain theirs. But I'm interested in the topic, and I find it fascinating that this one taboo of the Holocaust stands like a bloated, decaying, rotten, sacred cow in our midst, and yet so few decide to take a closer look at it. Now, I'm not asking you to believe anything. That's not the point of this program. I hope you understand that, and that we can appeal to your reason and logic instead, as I don't get much out of blind faith in any direction, be that for or against. The question is if you want to know. That is the central point right here. All we can do is to point in the direction of the work of other people and hope, of course, to raise enough interest for you to look into things for yourself. I think something horrible is happening in our world when the purported victim has gained so much power. We live in a world of victim hierarchy, and the most victimized one is always right. And to question this would be not only a crime, it's just incredibly offensive, insensitive, and hateful, right? But I think we need to think about this. Just because you pose yourself as a victim, somehow everything you say is truthful and there's never any reason to doubt your word or testimony, and it should never be challenged. Well, what if someone takes advantage of this? The accused is always at fault in our world today. No court of law, well, that isn't too corrupt, would just ask one side of the story. But in the court of public opinion, this is precisely what has happened in our past, our history, and it continues to happen today. We always have to feel guilt and sorrow for the victim. If someone has gotten hurt or if someone has been violated, we're not allowed to ask, in a time of grief or hurt, what the proof of their allegations are. We're just expected to blindly believe them.
What, are you saying that I'm lying?
Well, yeah, perhaps you are. Perhaps you're taking advantage of this. I don't know. If we're not able to inquire, there is simply no way for us to know, is there? And that's simply what this is all about. We're never asked to prove a negative. It's always, you know, prove that I murdered him, never prove that I didn't murder him. It's the accusation that has to be proven, not the other way around. But there is where we are today, unfortunately. We are asked by people who offer no proof to prove that something didn't happen. You know, there's been plenty of stories in the past of lies that have been exposed by inquiring and persistent minds that basically couldn't see reality matching up with the story that we've been told. And of course, we've come to realize that there are fabrications and lies in many different areas of life in order to justify subsequent activities. You know, there's still a majority of people out there who never inquired about 9/11. They just would tell you, what are you looking into this for? Just get over it already, will you? We already know what happened, okay? People say that about weapons of mass destruction as well, or that Saddam had something to do with 9/11, or that you know, Libya was invaded on good grounds. You know, these are major, major lies by our dear establishment. I think we would do good to question them and look into them further, don't you think? So what I think is going on here, in my view, is that we have a lot of people in this field that feel that good hard evidence hasn't been provided. We've gotten plenty of emotional stories and movies and documentaries with an agenda, but once you begin to look at much of the evidence, it seems that it doesn't stand up to the scrutiny of those people challenging it. And the people who are revising some of the available material makes an interesting point, and I think it's worth listening to. I think this is one of the reasons why it's not dragged into the sunlight, and this is why it's banned to question it, because if there were to take these accusations seriously, the arguments possibly wouldn't stand. I don't know. I can't figure it out. I don't know what other reason there would be. There is no other historical event that has these repercussions associated with it. Truth fears no investigation. And I hope that you are fearless, a fearless truth seeker, and indeed are a person brave enough and sane enough to let the truth lead you where it may. So I think it's good to drag this topic into the light and give it a chance and hear that other side that never gets heard in the mainstream. It's just gets ridiculed and shunned. Just because you listen to something doesn't mean you have to believe it. Remember that too. This is what they don't want you to do, of course, for some reason. They want you to quickly know that this is off limits, unacceptable, and only something that a mass murdering psychopath would listen to or entertain. I think that this is done in order to deflect you away from you using your own brain on this matter, so that there is no remote possibility that potentially the greatest lie of the 20th century, the false flag of our times, is something that more and more people would begin to take an interest in. So, with that little thought, thank you for entertaining my point. I hope you see what I'm trying to say. But with no further ado, I'd like to now introduce our guest. Nick Kellerstrom, PhD, has two History of Science degrees, one from Cambridge, 1968, plus a PhD from London, 95. He was an honorary member of the staff of UCL for 11 years. He has held an interest in hermetic alchemical issues and is presently managing New Alchemy Press. He co-edited The Case Against War. He was a spokesman comprising the CND legal arguments against the Iraq War, and then co-organized the Belgrano Inquiry in 1986, publishing The Unnecessary War as its proceedings in 1998. In 2008, he received widespread publicity and ethical damnation, owing to his interest in studies and the residual cyanide levels found in the walls of the World War II labor camps, and was thrown out of his college. He authored the book Terror on the Tube, a comprehensive account of the 2005 London bombings, endorsing the hypothesis of Islamic innocence. More recently, he has published Breaking the Spell, The Holocaust's Myth and Reality, which is the book we're going to talk about here today. It could be the first British textbook on the subject. Let's get to our guest. Nick Kellerstrom, thank you so much for coming on the program with us. It's great to have you here. Thank you so much for being here.
It's a pleasure. Pleasure, Hendrik. Yeah.
Thank you so much, Nick. Now, this is a very important topic we're going to talk about here today, a very interesting one. It's just one of those bizarre things that have historically turned out in the way that it has, and we find ourselves in a situation where we, at least in Europe now, are practically unable to speak about it. But before we get into the meat of the conversation, let's just kind of clear off some things off the table here first. Obviously, you wrote about the London 7/7 bombings prior to this, the false flag, the inside job.
Right.
Tell us about how you got on the track of writing about the Holocaust, Nick.
The Holocaust. Well, I was a science historian at UCL, my college, University College London, and my mother was a chemist. And I suppose I'm a bit sort of anti-establishment, and if I'm told something's really forbidden, then I want to have a look at it. And it came to my notice that people had measured and analysed cyanide in the walls of the old German labour camps. And I thought, as a science historian, this is a kind of real physical data that I like, and I know how to analyse. And several different people had sampled this cyanide from the walls. And it was like a memory of what happened 60 years ago, because the cyanide had bonded with the iron in the walls and it was still there. So this is fairly simple, fairly straightforward. It didn't involve complicated political opinions. OK, it was a kind of ground basis for talking about the subject. How had cyanide, a lot of cyanide had been used in the German labour camps. And this was a nice, clean, straightforward lead in. You know, I do like simple issues of inorganic chemistry. And it told you basically where the cyanide had been massively and routinely used in the German labour camps. And that was what pulled me in. And when I got thrown out of my college, I noticed the very intense sort of ethical damnation I was receiving. Nobody wanted to talk about this. They all branded me as a Nazi and branded me as far right and branded me as anti-Semite. And I was a bit puzzled by these labels. I didn't really know what they meant. I thought that Nazis hadn't existed for 50 years, you know. My mother used to be worried that I was a bit too far left in previous stuff. Earlier in my life, I always worked for anti-war movements and peace movements. And my mother worried this was a bit left-wing and might inhibit my employment prospects. And suddenly people were telling me I was far right. And again, I was quite puzzled by this. So my hope that this was something we could talk about that was simple and rational was not fulfilled. It turned out to be something that we couldn't actually talk about. So the process of publishing one or two articles about, for example, one was called The Walls of Auschwitz. Another was called Leuchter 20 years on. Fred Leuchter was the guy who initially went out there and sampled, chipped away at the old German walls, the old delousing chambers and alleged human gas chambers. And So 20 years ago, 20 years after that, I wonder what was going to happen in April. It was April 88. He did that. So April 2008, turned out what happened was me being thrown out of my college. That was, as it were, the 20-year anniversary event.
Right, right. Well, you know, later I wanted to ask you a little bit more about, you know, why or, you know, how you were thrown out of the university. It's an interesting story there, just for the sake of having people understand how you know, terribly, you know, suppressed this material is and some of the consequences are when you talk about it. But before we get into the meat of the conversation and talk about some, just tell us for a moment about your academic background, if you will, so people know what you have in your backpack, so to speak, Nick.
Yeah, well, University College London was founded on the basis that it would not vet people for religious or ideological beliefs, that it was supposed to be a free-thinking college. And I had a safe perch in a history science department called Science and Technology Studies. I've been there for quite a long time, took my PhD there. And I had, it was actually history astronomy. And I did nice obscure papers about how Newton formulated his theory about the moon and how Neptune was discovered. Especially I was last 5 years or so, I was into the discovery of Neptune. I published about 24 academic papers in the history of astronomy, which was quite an interesting topic for me. Obviously, I much enjoyed it. But it's not a very general interest. I have to admit that not very many people wanted to talk about it.
Right. Now, how do you think one should approach the subject then? Because it's very difficult. A lot of people are very emotionally upset. It's very difficult to reason with people. It's, I mean, you approach this solely from a scientific point of view, which I think is a great way to do it. It's kind of like you have to compartmentalize a bit before you can actually look at the bigger picture in order to understand the components, because people are so bogged down with the, as you said, the political stuff, the ideological stuff, the emotional stuff. So what would you say to people who, let's say, are unwilling to listen to some of the things that you found at the outset here as a way to appealing to them, to have them listen to what you found and the research that actually is out there about the science, Nick?
Yeah. Well, my colleague Jim Fetzer, the introduction to my book, he's a professor of logic, and he's got a nice way of putting things in terms of the colours that are involved. People believe in these huge cyanide gas chambers, where if they had been used, they would have to have blue colour in the walls, because when the cyanide sinks into the walls, it gives you this iron cyanide, which is ferrocyanide blue, and it's not there, whereas it is in the little delousing chambers, which are being written out of history, and they're out in Birkenau, quite little, relatively small buildings, where the cyanide was massively used for delousing clothing and mattresses and so on. So that's one colour change that's important. And the other colour change concerns human beings, that if people are gassed with cyanide, they go pink. Okay, there's a death struggle where oxygen is denied to the body and you end up with a bright, shocking pink corpse. And there's not a single report of a pink corpse in any Nuremberg testimony, okay? So this is kind of like bad science. They try to claim at Nuremberg that people have been killed with cyanide. Sometimes they say they'll have a bluish pallor or a greenish pallor or a bit blackish. But cyanide, medically, it does give you a blue corpse. And the other gas that was supposed to be massively used in the German labor camps was carbon monoxide. It was supposed to be traditionally one-third of the Holocaust, one-third of people were gassed, especially at places like, say, Treblinka or whatever. They alleged, oh, yes, the wicked Germans used diesel and they gassed people with carbon monoxide. Well, it happens that that also gives you a pink corpse, okay? For slightly different biochemistry, but you do end up with a pink corpse in both of those cases. And there's no trace of huge piles of pink corpses in any German labor camp report, no account in World War II whatsoever of that. I think you could just think in terms of these quite simple color effects, whereby the cyanide human gassing actually did not happen. You actually cannot show any gas corpse cyanide. You can't show a single one. There's never a single post-mortem or recorded death in German labor camp of cyanide death, and you get big record, whether or not you think they're trustworthy, big records kept in German labor camps of death certificates and causes of death. Nothing I'm guessing.
What do they have in terms of evidence here then? I mean, how, tell us, for those who don't know, how detailed are they? Are they reports? Are there accompanying photographs? And I guess a certain portion of this would be from you know, German itself, and other reports would be from when the Allied came into the camps, right? So there's two different things.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, two right hundred, yes. When the Soviets liberated Auschwitz, they took all of the death records. And these were kept secret for a long time, but they had the total comprehensive records of all the recorded deaths at Auschwitz. And these were only published by Gorbachev, released by Gorbachev, and they're actually published in three large volumes in the mid-1990s, Death Books of Auschwitz. And I found that nobody seemed to know much about these, so I went to the British Library, as I do, and there's a nice chapter in English giving all these statistics, which was wonderful, totals, and we put them up on our website called whatreallyhappened.info, and you can count them if you like. Yeah, and it gives causes of death, okay? And I mean, I would say the causes of death in the camps were mainly famine and typhus and typhoid from the epidemics. Just to give you some rough figures, the death books of Auschwitz have more Catholics than Jews dying, okay? You've got about 30,000 Catholics registered as dying, as having died, and 29,000 Jews registered as having died, and something like around 70,000 total deaths recorded.
Right.
Okay?
Yeah.
Now, people say, oh, well, of course, there's unrecorded deaths. So, well, maybe there were some, yeah. But based on some other data that I come to, I would say the unreported deaths were something like 10%. Extra, that they were giving very thorough, meticulous records, counting that every day the totals, total people who came in, total people who came out, and they broke down in the German labor camps the totals of the people there into four different categories. They had Poles, Russians, Jews, and Germans, the latter being German political prisoners. Okay, those were their four categories that they tried to keep account of who was in the labor camps. Now, to answer your question about the death records, were therefore in these death books of Auschwitz, which are month by month, broken down month by month, so it's quite helpful, just the kind of way we'd like to see statistics. And also, you've got a huge database of what used to be called the Arlesen Archives in North Germany, okay? This is the International Red Cross. For 50 years, the International Red Cross kept all data, all reports of alleged Holocaust victims and all claims for Holocaust compensation victims went through this archive, and it gradually built up into a massive database. And there have been several occasions, 1970s, 1980s, 1990s, in which they put out totals. Now, there's a total number of deaths, which they broke down into about 13 or then 15 different labor camps. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
We would like to have them broken down month by month and year by year, but they didn't do that. But we have got total deaths, and that corroborates the figure I just mentioned, the death books of Auschwitz. You've got Auschwitz something like between 60 and 70,000 total deaths given by the Arlesen Archives. Now, that is what has been made public by the Arlesen Archives. They haven't made public any figures in the 21st century, because there's a much stronger taboo, as I'm sure you're aware.
Sure.
Anyone in Germany allegedly denying the Holocaust gets put in jail. So if the Arlesen Archive did come out with those figures again, I think they would be, you know, there'd be prosecutions and so on.
Right.
But they have on three occasions come out with those figures. And I think that's very credible. And partly because of the way the data is broken down through all the different German labor camps, and also it's compatible with the death books. The Arlesen Archive does give causes of death, but that hasn't been released. But we do have a letter from the manager in the mid 2006, the manager of the Arlesen Archive, saying he has there are no record of any death by gassing in the Arlesen Archive.
Really?
Okay, that is a letter. So I think that's quite significant. So those are two central, primary, and credible sources about the number of people who died in the German labor camps.
And so those are, just to clarify then, that those are German sources themselves, right? The we hear that, of course, they had meticulous documentation about everything. They were very, you know, keeping up with all the paperwork and everything else. So what would you say to those people then who say, well, you know, okay, they didn't write about those things. These are things that were undocumented. How do we deal with that issue?
Right. The first one is German, the Death Books of Auschwitz. And the second one is not. The International Red Cross is definitely not German, but although it's located in North Germany, they have, as I said, international, and they have compiled this data. I was able to write my book because of an astonishing discovery in England, which is a different source of data, which is just as absolutely reliable, and that is the British intelligence decrypts. For a whole 12 months, British intelligence was able to decrypt, crack German codes, okay, at Bletchley Park, crack the codes, decrypt the signals being sent out from the German labour camps. So for a whole year, you have all the accounts sent out, formally sent out from the camps to the National Socialist headquarters about how they were doing and how things were going over 1942 to 1943. And as well as the very fascinating accounts of what was going on in the camps, you have the total amount of people living in the camps.
Right.
That's what I just alluded to,
as
broken down those four different groups. Okay, so that's different from the total number of people dying. And it's very interesting to compare the number of people alive in the camps with the number of people dying. And you've got a daily record of how many people come into the camp and how many people leave it in those British intelligence decrypts for each of the camps. And
that's related to the famous Enigma code, right? That one of the British.
Yeah,
exactly. That's what you got that data out from that particular. When they broke that code, they realized, all right, something's going on. People are coming in, they're coming out. There are deaths that are occurring, right?
Right, yeah. And so the Enigma code is famous for telling the British intelligence about German submarines and so on. But nobody talks at all about this data, which was only released in the mid-90s, same as the Death Books of Auschwitz. No historians want to know about it, Hendrik, because it fails to show any sign of the Holocaust, okay? There's no trace of any Holocaust going on in what you overhear in these camp reports. There's the great struggle to get useful work out of the different ethnic groups they had moving around the camps. There's all sorts of accounts of people being sent to and fro the different camps. There's no trace of any disrespect towards Jews that they are alluded to as having various types of skills in which their labour can be used. They move from one camp to another, then the shattering event in the middle of 42 was the arrival of typhus, and that primarily hit Auschwitz. I think other camps as well, and that was a disease thought to be extinct. And suddenly, you get 30% of all the males in the Auschwitz camp die in 1 month, and so the ensuing months are a scene of absolute horror. As the German authorities try to suddenly get in this the new protocol for dealing with it, which they call special treatment, and obviously Holocaust historians try to make out that as some process for exterminating people, the special treatment they implemented very swiftly involved building the delousing chambers,
right?
Building the cremation ovens, because you had huge numbers of people dying, and the catch was that you could not bury people at Auschwitz. The ground was too damp, all sorts of rivers, various rivers around. It would just pollute the entire water supply if you buried people. So every corpse had to be burned. It was rather macabre. And so that was installed, and all new arrivals had to take their clothes off, get shaved, get showered, and all their clothing had to be deloused.
So that's just to be clear there, Nick, that's something that started then, you say, after 1942, correct?
It was mid-42, they started getting those protocols into place.
Right, okay.
I was able to show, because I've been a school maths teacher, Henry, I do like a bit of number crunching, actually. I was able to show that whereas in August 42, 30% of the males died in 1 month, that went down by about a factor of 10 to about 3% a year later. So the cyanide gas chambers were very effective for the hygienic purposes for which they were designed. I mean, people forget now that for about 40 years, Zyklon was the standard hygiene technology for killing bugs. Okay, you just had this granules, you had to warm the granules slightly, cyanide came off, cyanide killed all the bugs, and that took an hour or two in your gas chamber, okay, gas camera. And then you just put the clothes out to air, let the wind blow through them to get any cyanide out, and that was it. It was a pretty safe procedure. Those operators, you didn't even have to wear gas masks. It was quite good German technology whereby the cyanide was used. Many tons of cyanide were used in this way, and I would say that that was quite relatively successful in coping with the big outbreak of typhus. Now, that is shown and described in the British intelligence decrypts. You get accounts, for example, in September 42, the whole of Auschwitz is quarantined. Nobody can come or go because of this terrific disease raging, and they're struggling to get it under control.
Right.
So I would say you've got a very dramatic close-up view of the German labor camps through the British intelligence decrypts, and virtually no historians want to know about them for this reason, you know.
Right.
We failed to show the Holocaust going on.
So these were kind of really hermetically sealed chambers, right? They were smaller, almost. They were, some of them were, of course, housed just to fit the clothing in itself, right? And so we've had a disconnect, as far as I've been able to tell, between what we're presented as with the proof of gas chambers versus the chambers that they used to de-louse the clothes. Is that correct?
Absolutely correct. Yeah, yeah. As you say, they were hermetically sealed. They're 10 cubic meters in volume. And they had just a routine, normal process. And the whole world forgot about this at Nuremberg. The most extraordinary thing that happened at Nuremberg in 46 was the process of collective amnesia. By that time, DDT was taking over as the new chemical for delousing clothes. And at Nuremberg, just presenting a counter Zyklon was taken as evidence of some kind of homicidal intent. The narrative of the normal, routine, ordinary hygiene technology was just blotted out. In fact, I can give a simple definition of Holocaust denial in one sentence, Hendrik. If you believe that normal hygiene technology worked in an ordinary, normal manner in the German labor camps, and that the Zyklon did exactly what it was supposed to do, what it said on the can, then you are a Holocaust denier.
Really? Really? Oh boy!
That's what I would say. What I would say it accounts to. But
right.
Normal good citizens have to believe in this terrific phantom hallucination of huge human gas chambers. Which, as a science historian, I just have to say, they have never existed on planet Earth anywhere, and they would be physically impossible if you tried to build them and make them work with the Zyklon. I don't think you could use them, and the reason they never existed. It is that they wouldn't work. But that's my conclusion as a science historian.
And why is that? Why wouldn't they work?
Glad you asked, Hendrik. They have to be hermetically sealed. You have to get 1,000 people, or however many you think you want, into a huge chamber. Well, how do you do that? You get them all to crush in. Now, if you can get it hermetically sealed, then they'll die far more quickly from asphyxiation than they would from putting in these very slow-release Zyklon tablets. So for a start, if you could cram them all into a hermetically sealed chamber, you wouldn't have any need to use Zyklon, okay? Then the chambers we've seen would be, what were shown as the buildings, would easily be smashed, have doors and windows that can easily be broken. And the famous one, 30 million of troops through Auschwitz, has got a drain in the middle of the floor, so it's quite obviously some sort of washroom,
right?
And if you had cyanide draining through, that would have poisoned the entire water supply and the whole camp would get gassed.
This would spread to the personnel themselves, and of course this would be in such a way that they would suffer from it too, right? Because what I've seen some of the other footage of this, and they're showing of course, how the doors, for example, in the, some of these facilities didn't go all the way down to the floor. It was not hermetically sealed. It was very, rickety doors, and the there was windows even in them, right?
Exactly, yeah. I recommend everyone to watch the David Cole video, which he made in 1991. Absolute classic. This very white, very shrewd young Jew visits Auschwitz and gets the story out. And he managed to get the story out that the tourist gas chamber that 30 million have gone through now was built after the war by Stalin. It's a post-war construction. It's kind of theatre. It's a theatrical post-war construction.
Tell us what we see. I mean, it's excellent. David Cole's expose of what he brings to the table is excellent. We've tried to get him on the show too, by the way. We'll see if we can do that here in the future. But
all right, yeah.
Tell us about what people see then today, right? The tourist attraction, as it has become now, of I guess we can talk about Auschwitz first. There's many different camps, of course, and different things that went on there. But
okay, well, this is compulsory. School kids around Britain, compulsory schools have to send kids out to Auschwitz, right? And alas, the kids are not taken to see the gas chambers, which I think is a great shame. I think go all the way. The little delousing chambers with blue walls, they don't see those at all. They're not taken to see the swimming pool, which again I think is a great shame. That there's quite an elegant swimming pool which has been done up now around the back of the base camp, so they don't see that
for the inmates, right? That's what you're talking about.
I think it was for the inmates. Yeah. Inmates and maybe SS2. I don't know if they're showing the football pitch. David Gold pointed out there's a large football pitch in which SS officers and inmates played together. That is just in the front of what is alleged, where the alleged human gas chamber was. Now they're taken through this big. It's a long room, which did not exist as such during the war. It's had a wall broken down in the middle, I think. And during the war, it had different purposes. For example, maybe an air raid shelter, and part of it was a washroom, as we can see, and had just quite a flimsy door. And what they've done, they've knocked huge. They've reconstructed the roof with huge holes in the ceiling to give you the message that Zyklon was put through these holes in the ceiling. Okay, there's no authentic building anywhere in any German labor camp with holes in the ceiling. Absolutely does not exist. So that is a post-war construction based on the imagination of what Hoss was forced to confess to after he'd been tortured. You've got this phantom story of holes in the roof appearing.
Right. And you've shown maps too of the facilities and the different components to it that people are not shown. We had, of course, even testimony about theaters, movie theaters, right? We had they had orchestras, they had football games and things like this. So what is the disconnect here between, where are we getting the image of the construction, if I can call it that, versus the what you think really happened there? How do we separate those two and look at them like, okay, what is the truth? We have one version here, which is...
Yeah. Well, I think the best thing to do, Hendrik, is to focus on what did happen and try and inform people of what Auschwitz was actually for. What was it for? That's easy to answer. It was a hard-working labour camp, and it had huge industrial processes going on, okay? Monowitz was the huge chemical plant which had the tremendously advanced German technology of getting oil for the German war machine out of coal and coke, okay? This was catalytic cracking, which was quite advanced at the time. There were various blast furnaces working at Auschwitz for manufacturing. There was especially a synthetic rubber plant. It's called Buna synthetic rubber, which were, again, quite new and advanced German chemistry. The rest of the world was getting their rubber from the jungles of Malaysia. This was synthetic rubber being made at Auschwitz. You can see the remains of various arms industry plants that inmates would trek out to every morning. So the first simple answer what Auschwitz was for, it was a hard-working labour camp. Okay, that's the first answer. And then I would say, in order to get efficient work out of the inmates, or for whatever reason, there were these amenities that you have mentioned. There was a theatre. There were various different orchestras. There were films shown at weekend. There was a hospital that Anne Frank describes a father being treated there and recovering. It has some quite advanced stuff there. There was a bakery. There was a brothel set up by Mark 43, some sort of reward. The inmates at Auschwitz had money. They had
their own,
some sort of
currency.
Money.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and they could buy stuff like cigarettes if they were lucky, if it was available. There wasn't a lot they could buy, you know. As far as I make out, visits were allowed from certain periods that the wives or whatever could come and visit. There are postcards been sent out from Auschwitz, you know.
And just to clarify one thing then here for people, I guess as well on top of it, what you're saying is not, you know, that they were there of their own free will, etc. This is not what we're talking about here. This is just to show that the conditions at the work camps are not in accordance with the descriptions that we get of them. It doesn't mean that they weren't there. They were, of course, forcefully put there, many of them.
Yeah,
of course, they were prisoners.
People trying to escape will be shot.
Yeah,
and that's in the British decrypts of records of when people do get shot. For example, I'll give an example. When the big typhus epidemic broke out, there's a record of a whole busload of Poles being taken out into the wood and shot. And as I read it, the Poles tried to introduce the typhus into the staff, to give the staff that illness.
Oh, really?
And they were suspected of having introduced it into the camp. So that was payback for them. There was discipline, yeah.
Sure,
Rudolf Voss had strict disciplinary requirements whereby SS officers were not allowed to mistreat or beat or strike prisoners. And there are accounts of SS officers being dismissed who did so. But this is very much ignored nowadays with the... you see, they got the nightmare image of Rudolf Voss after they captured him. A British army hit squad captured him and tortured him for 3 days and three nights. And then he broke down with no sleep and alcohol. And he just signed what they wrote out for him.
Right, yeah.
You know, oh, yeah, sure, yeah. I murdered 2 million people. and that is what he's famous for.
So just to clarify again here, the you know, obviously you wouldn't want to kill your workers if they're an intricate part of an industrial or process of developing something, be that those armaments or rubber or what have you, right? But at the same time, you know, you want to treat them in such a way that they will continue to work. So in other words, when the typhus epidemic breaks out, they're in effect trying to save the worker, the inmates. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. Let's be clear about this. My book describes orders going out from the highest level. National Socialist Authority, mortality in the camps must be reduced at all costs. And this is done by hygiene and by improved food and nutrition. And that's absolute priority. Those who advocate the Holocaust extermination thesis have been driven to a position over several decades now where they have to admit there are no documents whatsoever indicating any order to exterminate Jews or anybody else. And they're more or less cornered into admitting that it's all done by ESP, that the drive to exterminate people was a shared mutual understanding without anything in writing. Well, this is absolute nonsense. And the documents that do exist give this mandate to reduce mortality. And I think the concept of death camp, the death camps developed at the end of the war in 1944-1945. The grim horror as British carpet bombing, you know, 2.5 million tons, Central Europe, say Belsen, Bergen-Belsen, had no food or water towards the end of the war. So everything they tried to set up in those camps went wrong. And you just did get the massive mortality, which could obviously be used very effectively in atrocity propaganda by the victors, and was.
Now, I want to ask you a little bit more about that later, what the Allied actually encounters when they come to some of these camps and what have you. But let's just for a moment talk more about the gas chambers and what you think might have happened here. Because, you know, if the tourists that go there today are presented with a reconstruction, what do you think happened there? I mean, one, we have the Soviets then possibly building some of these things up, a reconstruction, as you said. But how do you think that this coincides with... let's say what the you know, quote, survivors unquote say when you know, in their testimony and agreeing to this story? I've always been curious to know the agreement here, if there was ever, and this is speculation, I understand that, but do you think that there was an agreement at some point that, yes, let's present this story? Or is it something that has kind of evolved over time, and what we get today is kind of a reconstruction of different parts?
If you look, before Hoss's testimony, you look at stories of gas chambers as it develops in the sort of nightmare and confusion of war. There were rumors. There were rumors. Oh, yes, Auschwitz, you know, they've got gas chambers. Certainly there were these rumors. And if you look at them, these don't bear any relation to what Hoss confessed to. They're not, it's not similar. Once the whole thing had been stamped at Nuremberg and made official, that then became the consensus, became a post-war consensus of what you had to believe. Hoss originally confessed to the idea of shower units, and shower units, out of that would come gas instead of water, and then everyone dropped down dead. And people said, well, look, this might not work very well. The hydrogen cyanide is lighter than air, so it would stay up the top, and also the Zyklon granules give off gas slowly. It wouldn't be easy to get it piped along coming out of shower units. So it was then modified. The second version of Hoss's thing had holes knocked in the holes in the roof, and the SS people shoved it down through the roof. And then that still wasn't good enough, and people then imagined a third version that there was some sort of tubes from the roof down to the ground, and you get complicated drawings of these, which are quite imaginary, whereby Zyklon was inserted.
Right.
And that became a post-war consensus then. And the victorious nations just did want to do in the ethos of the German people. I think they all shared that wish for various reasons, and they agreed on this narrative. Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit later here about the survivors and what they say and what have you. But before we go there, let's talk about the Allies then, what they encountered when they got to the camps. And of course, we do have footage of massive amounts of bodies. There, as you said, there is carnage. There's things. We have the typhus epidemic that you've described. We have that on one end, but there's other things that are happening at the same time, because we've had German supply lines, of course, cut off. We'd had a tremendous, just as you said, the chaos of war itself creates maybe not a priority to take care of the inmates at these kinds of camps, but they go to the war effort itself. So what happens here at the end of the war, and how did this kind of spiral out of control, and you get more and more deaths as a consequence?
Well, if I may just say the what happened at Bergen-Belsen, there's a famous picture of a huge bulldozer shoveling loads of corpses into a big ditch, and that's somehow supposed to be linked up with the Holocaust. It's actually an English soldier in that bulldozer, and they're arriving after the war, and these are the piles of the dead are absolutely famished. You can see their ribs sticking out. They've died of famine, basically, and they're so thin and starving that this is evidence against the gassing hypothesis.
Right.
In fact, the Americans sent their top pathologist, Charles Larson, to investigate, to find out what had happened to all these dead bodies. And he then went to Dachau and Auschwitz immediately after the war, and he refused to say any of them had been gassed. He said, no, look, this is typhus, this is famine. And he's been quite eminent for post-mortem analysis in America. And there's a book about him, Crime Doctor, and he would not say they were a poison gas were found.
Right.
If I could just come back just to what we were saying just a minute before, Hendrik, as to what the buildings were that were imagined to be gas chambers. You've got the small little buildings outside and in Birkenau and so on that are really written out of history as the delousing chambers, and those are ignored at Nuremberg. And after the war, they slowly turned blue. The wall slowly turned blue. And that is Mother Nature, as it were, playing a trump card. It's showing you where the cyanide was actually used. And that is what revisionists latched onto in the 80s, when revisionism really got going with the Zundel trials in Canada. They went and measured where the blue colour was. Okay, so that was the clue. Now, in central German land camps, you've got two types of building. One was the morgue. This is both next to where all the furnaces were. But the morgue, which is a long, thin building where all the stiffs were stored up. Okay, and this is quite a cold building, with very slow ventilation. And the other was the washrooms. So those both really existed. Okay,
right.
Out of those writing the Holocaust textbooks, imagine what they call Kramer, K-R-E-M-A. That's what they call them, the Kramer, which they imagine as being huge human gas chambers. And if you look at what they actually physically were, they were one of those two types of room, either a washroom or a place for storing stiffs, a morgue. And those rooms were actually being used as such during the war. They were not vacant rooms available for some other use. So when the retreating Nazis, as it were, left the camps, there was nothing resembling a human gas chamber in anywhere. There were some blown up buildings or shattered buildings, and people said, oh, well, of course, the evil Nazis destroyed all records.
Right,
They keep being credited with these powers of getting rid of the evidence.
But that doesn't help us, does it? It's still the burden of proof is still on those who try to claim that something has happened, not the other way around, correct?
Well, it should be. It should be, yes.
Right.
I mean, the whole image of a human gas chamber is a phantom hallucination, and it hovers around the actual gas chambers, which, at least in this country, nobody wants to know about, which is quite normal hygiene technology. And the image of these huge, terrifically efficient gas chambers that killed 1,000 people in 20 minutes. This is a kind of transcendental mythos, and it's almost not available to factual debate and discussion, you know.
No, it isn't. That's just it. It's shut down immediately right away. And, you know, just as you got suspicious about that, I agree with that. I get suspicious about that, too. Why can't we talk about it, right?
Well, do you think it's something like, is it a new religion, for example? Is this a transcendental world religion, a Holocaustian faith that is taking over? Is this a compulsory new world religion,
right,
in which this vision of ghastly horror is at the centre of it? That for no reason Nazis wanted to gas millions of Jews, and had this technology that never existed before the war, never existed after the war, only existed in Poland, and somehow they could use to kill millions of people without any physical trace being left. This is all non-physical. It's metaphysical. It's kind of like a transcendent mythos, and most people have compared it to the witch trials. I mean,
exactly.
Witches.
Yeah.
They said, oh, well, you've been to a witch's sabbath, haven't you? They said, well, no. And the judge would say, look, I'm not sure we really need to burn this old woman. You know, couldn't we just let her off? And they've said, oh, no, a lenient judge. The lenient judge would also be convicted.
Exactly. Well,
that's a bit like what's happening in Germany now. No, lawyers don't dare defend so-called Holocaust deniers because they themselves get tried then.
Right, exactly.
Like Sylvia Stoltz got tried because she defended Ernst Zundel.
Yeah, that's correct. Well, let's get to the more later here of the propaganda aspect, both the Allied propaganda, but kind of the reconstructions, the fabrications, the cover-up, and the reasons for this later. We have so much more to cover here, but let's go through it kind of as much as we can here, work our way forward. But let's talk about the logistics a little bit and how many would have to pass through a lot of these facilities to reach the number that we're told. I saw a very interesting film made called One Third of the Holocaust that showed the impossibility of the of the vast, what do you call it, like graves, I guess you could call it, themselves, of how much room you would have to make to
was
be able to...
Was that about Treblinka? Is that Treblinka?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, that is so good, that story. I just love it, you know.
Yeah, because they show the math. They show the what you would have to do, how much you would have to dig up to you know, bury all the bodies and everything. And it's just when you realize the numbers, that's what I was shocked about, was that when you realize the numbers, you realize how much of an area you would have to cover. I know that there are stories of this aspect that they later dug them up and burned them again and crushed their bones and things like that, right? It's a tremendous work process nonetheless. But tell us about the logistics and the numbers and all this issue.
Well, again, it's like a phantom hallucination. Treblinka now is a wide open green field, slight undulations on it with trees around it, okay? And nobody's found any gas bodies or any dead bodies apart from a Christian burial ground nearby. Nobody's found any trace of gas chambers. We had the Birmingham Science Department send a survey over there and had some ground-penetrating radar. And there was a big hoo-ha promoted by the BBC and newspapers saying, oh, this refutes the views of revisionists, you know. We've shown the dreadful things that went on at Treblinka. It's just an open field with... maybe some stones underneath it. Treblinka was what we call a transit camp. It's part of Operation Reinhardt, and it's on the eastern border of Poland. So we talked about the labor camps. There were a few transit camps which did not have the character of trying to get labor out of people, but there were camps that people passed through quite quickly, okay? Sobibor, Belzec, Treblinka were the main ones, okay? And they were near the border of Poland, Russia. And I think, revisionists tend to think, surmise, this was because of the change in railway gauge. As trains went out from Poland to Russia, you had to stop and get off. And Treblinka was quite near this railway junction. And I think they would come there to be deloused and just to get fed a bit and on their way out east. Perhaps I could mention here, Hendrik, that... there were, as it were, two different purposes of the German labor camps. The initial purpose was to, as it were, to get Jews out of Germany and flush them out traveling eastwards. So what the Endlösung der Judenfrage, people call the final solution, which is meant the goal solution of the Jewish question, Germany finally decided it wanted most of its Jews to leave, and they were sent out eastwards towards Poland, and that was the initial impasse, I think, of various German camps. And then it became difficult or impossible for many of those camps for the Jews to be sent where Germany hoped they could be sent. The main plan actually was Madagascar, which they got some sort of agreement with the French who owned the island to send Jews out to Madagascar, which is a paradise island, a rather lovely solution, I think. Unspoiled Paradise Island, and that became then unfeasible. And then around about the beginning of 1942, you got what you might call a second phase, where they were saying, "Okay, well look, we've got most people here, and we're going to get useful work out of them." And that became, as it were, a second phase. So these camps like Treblinka, which were transit camps, once more Operation Reinhardt. Just that people staying for a short time, and there's controversy about how many people there were at Treblinka, but it was a fairly small little camp. So just let me stress that there's no evidence for people being killed there. You've got stories, you've got terrific stories, of course.
How do you think that these came about? That's another thing here, and I'm not. Because
I can give a fairly straightforward answer.
Sure,
to that.
Yeah, go ahead.
Firstly, Jews got Israel out of these stories. Became evident off Nuremberg, Jews were going to get Israel because of this out of these stories. So that's one hell of a motivation. Okay.
Right. Right.
And the second thing is Germany started paying any Holocaust survivor. So anyone with a story will get paid by Germany.
Right, exactly.
Which is the worst possible motivation for people making up these stories. Germany has now spent well over 100 billion Deutschmarks, okay? It's had about 6 million claims put in by alleged Holocaust survivors. So that is the real 6 million, okay? Real 6 million claims put in. And it's given to about 4 million of them. And this is the last, since the World War II, it's given to, money to about 4 million alleged Holocaust survivors. And it's still paying out. Still paying something like, I don't know, 2 billion a year or something. Which goes mainly into the coffers of Israel.
Tremendous amounts of money. And I just want to mention something, another quote I read a while back. I don't know who it's from, unfortunately, but they said, and I thought that the point was good, because it stresses the issue that if you're, you know, paying money for something, you should be able to kind of expect evidence for it. Anyway, the quote is, whenever you make a long-term disability claim against an insurance company or the government, they repeatedly expect you to prove the damages and reprove them. They do not just take your word that you have been injured. So when Israel, and this person says this, when Israel sold the Holocaust for political and economic gain, Israel opened the Holocaust to repeated questioning. When Israel took monetary damages and rewards from Germany and around the world, you know, Israel gave them the right to question and demand proof of the Holocaust. And I thought that was a quite good good way of looking at this, right? That you would...
Yeah, I think that's a very fair way of looking at it, Hendrik. I mean, as we've seen, there's no one in Germany who's allowed to do that. You're
exactly.
Not allowed to doubt the story in Germany, or you suffer the same fate as Sylvia Stoltz in trying to defend someone legally. Germany puts in jail quite a lot of people, is it? 1,000 or 2,000 a year, supposedly, for thought crime. There are a lot of books being burnt in Germany, a lot of people being put in jail. I think the number is going up. So it's people like us in countries where it's not yet a crime to doubt the subject that can help. I'm very pro-German myself. I love the culture of Germany. I've great reverence for the glorious culture of Germany, I think.
Do you think that this has helped to completely destroy their culture and impose such a guilt that the Germany as we knew it is no longer there? Or how what has the damage been towards them?
I would think so, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, they're a very successful post-war culture, it's their traditional, their pride in their culture and nation has been blotted out, I would think, yes.
You know, it's another thing I want to mention here as well, because it's, you know, it's a difference. There's a difference, I would say, personally. You might have your own view on this, but to what they claim to be denying the Holocaust, as opposed to questioning, you know, how people were, because there, of course, there were people killed there. There were a lot of bodies that were found. It's not about that. It's about if it was a strategic, intentional effort to kill as many as possible, etc. But the very term Holocaust denier, of course, is kind of, it's one of those circular sentences or whatever you call it, when kind of like, you know, when did you stop beating your wife? It doesn't matter what you say, you know, it's so like, yeah, if you say, if you say yes, you know, you're a Holocaust denier. So if you say yes, you know, then you agree that it happened. If you say no, you also agree that it's happened. And so I guess that what you're saying here is that you take a different position, which is basically, I'm looking at the science of this. I'm trying to figure out what happened? Why did it happen? Are there political and monetary reasons for this? Is this part of you know, Allied war propaganda and the Soviets' intention to destroy Germany? Because what I found interesting too is that there are kind of other circumstantial evidence that we can add to the pile of the desire, for the lack of a better term, to destroy Germany even before the war. There's a lot of literature written of this, a lot of politicians in Britain too, like Churchill, who talked about, you know, that this is the destruction of Germany itself. He even said it doesn't matter if it's in the, you know, Nazis or what have you, the war is on Germany, right? So when you piece all of these things together, you realize that what if they jumped on this opportunity as a way to try to put a nail, as it were, in the coffin of Germany, right?
It's a wonderful European culture, and it's just been had this amazing lie put upon it. I mean, to come back to your question of are we denying the Holocaust and what is the Holocaust? I mean, I think we could probably agree that this is the worst collective experience that European Jews went through. I mean, they were uprooted, they were forced out of their homes, and a lot of them did die in the war. I think the number who died is not greater than the war in which 60 million people died. You've got maybe 2% Jews in Europe overall, something like that. And that gives you very roughly the number of Jews who died. There's no evidence for selective dying of Jews. But and in many ways, they were fortunate because they were moved out of German cities, which were then incinerated. So they avoided that ghastly horror of being burnt alive in German cities. And they were sent out to Poland, which was much relatively safer in many ways. Being in labor camp was safer than being in a German city. That helped them survive. So now, also, I think that,
Let me just ask you. I know that you necessarily don't take too much of a political view on this. I know that it's more about the science here, so I don't want to get sidetracked. But nonetheless, I know that there are things like trade wars and things like that that occurred before this. We have a very interesting document called not only the transfer agreement, but we have when Judea declared war on Germany, the trade agreement of dealing with them. So there's a lot of things that are at the run-up of this that actually created the type of scenario of why you saw the kind of separation or how the way that Germany wanted to break free, I guess, to that extent. I don't know what your view on that is, but my
view is that Germany, I don't see why Germany has to feel guilty about it. I mean, it started in 1293 when British people, the King of England kicked out the Jews, okay, tons ago, I think just about every country in Europe has done that at one time or another.
Sure.
Now, in the 1930s, Judea declared war against Germany. That was a massive economic boycott all over the world of German goods when Germany had to export to get the food that it needed. And it finally decided that these are like, they're behaving like an enemy of Germany. So they're put into labor camps for exactly the same reason as Americans put Japanese into labor camps after Pearl Harbor. They decided this was enemy alien. I can't see anything terribly wrong about this. I mean, if Jews are behaving in a way that's not friendly to their host country, I would have thought, you know, they should expect something to happen.
Now
I could perhaps add to Hendrik that there were many Jews who remained there. Berlin, the Berlin Synagogue remained open throughout the war, as my book described, and there's also a Berlin hospital for Jews that remained open through the war, and the Jews in Berlin were a damn sight more frightened of British-American aerial bombing than they were of the Nazis. So it wasn't a total flushing out of Jews. It was basically Jews who had power. They wanted Germany for the Germans. They succeeded, I believe, in getting a German national bank not controlled by the Rothschilds.
Right.
I suspect they're the only country in Europe in the 20th century that ever managed to do that.
There's a tremendous important point that people miss as well, and it's the fact that we had a country which dared to defy the globalist bankers at the time, right? And that is a huge reasoning for why what happened and specifically to Germany, and the fact that the whole world descended on Germany after the war and bombed them into smithereens, you know?
Totally, yeah.
Just to reemphasize that point, they tried to break away from the banking system. They tried to run things on their own. And this is like something which is highly taboo at the time to do, as it is today as well. We've seen, I've made the reference before, that we've seen countries that haven't been kind of tied to the global banking system, like Iraq or Libya, certain countries being invaded much in the same way and detoppled. And some of the first things that has happened is that a central bank has gotten in place there, and the country has gotten under the control of foreign interests. This is kind of Germany is kind of like one of the, not the first countries, of course, but since they broke out of the system that already was in place in Europe, they were to be punished for their deeds, for their attempts to try to do what they try to do, right?
Yeah. And right through the 30s, Jews were saying, we will bring war on Germany. Germany will have war, whether they want it or not. Germany is going to be destroyed by war. And they were predicting that they had the power to do it. And once war broke out, Jewish sources were saying, this is our war. We've got it going. We are with you. I think this is part of the mystery of our 20th century history, how a small group apparently has the power to do that, and what's going on. And it's a rather hidden and obscure matter. But I think the fact that Germany decided to do what every other country in Europe has decided to do once or another is not a cause for undying shame for Germany.
Yeah, definitely. Now, there's a lot of other things I want to ask you about here, more about the reasoning behind this, get into the details. We want to talk more about the Nuremberg trials. We want to talk about how, Germany was destroyed by bombs after this, and you've dug out some of the numbers with this as well. There's also more science here, of course, and testimony and things like that we need to discuss. But we're going to take a short break here between the segments. And before we do that, I want to ask you about your websites. I want to ask you to give your details, of course, about the book that we're talking about, Breaking the Spell, The Holocaust, Myth, and Reality. And where do people go to pick up a copy of the book if they want to read more about this and see what you found?
Oh, well, you just get it off Amazon, I suppose. I feel very proud of this book. It's very personal. I'm personally working through how I responded to this. Also, may I add, that it's published by Germán Rudolf, who's a scientist who was likewise put in jail in Germany, and he's checked through it. So I feel great confidence that every fact in this book is correct. I think it's a reliable source now, and I'm claiming that it's the only British textbook on the subject, that there are hundreds, maybe tens of thousands, pro-Holocaust books published, but I think this is the one revisionist textbook published in Britain, and so I feel quite proud of it. And it tries to take the kind of approach we've been discussing, Hendrik, which is based on scientific, rational discussion and debate, and it's opposing this new religion, compulsory new religion, with a priesthood that tells us what we have to believe.
Very good. A lot more I want to ask you about in the next segment here as we continue. A lot more things to discuss here. But in the meantime as well, I just want to mention your websites here. We have of course, the website's about the 7/7 London bombings is terrorontheTube.co.uk. Yeah. That's your other website. And then, of course, you have also whatreallyhappened.info, and that's a more website pertaining to the issue that we talked about today.
I could perhaps say there's a group of us British revisionists that meet up, which is quite a courageous thing for us to do. Hadn't happened before. And we sort of rap about things. I think then very much gave me the courage to write a book, having this bunch of people, different points of view, that we could talk about the ultimately forbidden things.
Yeah, well, exactly, you're right. I mean, this is the taboo, if there ever was one, and this is the one subject you're not allowed to talk about. So I think it's very important that you do, just for the sake of historical accuracy, just for the sake of offering a different opinion, just for the sake of offering something which is not in line with what everyone else is saying. And the people who are into academic diversity and questioning things, I see no reason whatsoever, even with all their emotion in mind, why they should not encourage that something like this is talked about. And I think it's even worse than that, than when we do have, governments and organizations actively going after people who are these are not crimes, but they try to pin it as that, of course. But they are not.
Right.
They are simply reevaluations of history, questioning the material that is available. And, we'll talk more about that in the second here, but it's almost like this disconnect that begins to happen. It could be quite frightening when you realize that the rest of the world is really in some kind of haze and complete mind control about the issue and things that you found, Nick. Where you realize that, my God, like, how can people not see some of this evidence that contradicts the story that we've been told? It's the ultimate false flag, really. But we'll talk more about that in the second segment. So stay with us, Nick. Stay with us, everybody. We'll be right back with more. And welcome back, everybody. We are talking about the forbidden subject, the Holocaust, with Nick Kellerstrom. And of course, It isn't just the Holocaust, because there have been a lot of Holocausts, if you want to call it that, around the world in different capacities. We've had Holocausts of Ukrainians, we've had Holocausts of Armenian people, we've had Holocausts of Swedish people when Christianity came into our northern lands. There's a lot of these destructive tendencies by a lot of different people around the world. But this one, for some reason, Nick, has been really zeroed out as the one and the only. And this is, I believe it's the only one as well that you're not allowed to talk about or question in a lot of countries around the world. There's no other treatment. This is really singled out as a unique event in human history.
Yeah. And it gets very much taught in classes. It's massively taught, indoctrinated in schools. And I was told in America that if people want to talk about their Native American Holocausts, that they're not allowed to. They're told, oh, just forget it, will you? Just get over it. Whereas this one, the motto is never forget. And there's massive, I don't know, in this country, I think it's more heavily taught than anything else. You get it in religion, you get it in history, you get it in social awareness classes, you get it in drama. And the poor kids get it thrust down their throat from about the age of seven onwards. They're taught how to hate. They're taught who to hate and how to hate by these classes. So I think our culture is getting very much deformed by it. And I could just mention, Hendrik, we just passed Holocaust Memorial Day, which has to be honoured by everyone. And we're here in London about plans for a massive new Holo temple, which is going to be built on the banks of the Thames, so everyone will see it. And we've already got a huge Holocaust museum in South London, and we've got various sculptures and stuff all over the place. So I'd have thought we had enough to keep us to remembering.
Yeah, it's definitely a constant reminder in that regard, and it's which always been fascinating to me, considering, for example, how many people died in the Soviet Union, for example, and the tremendous human history is full of atrocities. They don't count exactly.
In fact, 60 million people died in World War II. They hardly count.
Exactly. They're looking here. It's definitely a Holocaust of European peoples. I mean, both world wars have been a tremendous shock to the European people. But they don't have sure, you do have some cenotaphs in Britain commemorating the victory over Germany, I guess. But it's much more. It's not about commemorating the victims, right?
Certainly not. No.
So before we go further into this and talk more, Nick, about how you were treated at the university, how you were thrown out and some of the other issues behind here, let's talk a little bit more about some of the science behind this, because I think that's really the key to, of course, getting people to understand that there's something important here. You mentioned Fred Leuchter, you mentioned Germar Rudolph, there are some of the other people that have done some work on this. What are some of the other aspects of...
As a science historian, my training is that you go to primary source data. That is, you don't get secondary or tertiary sources or what other people say or Hollywood movies. You discover the primary sources. And that's what I like doing, okay? And that's why it's such a delight for me to find the British intelligence decrypts. And we put them up on our website, and we put various graphs showing the figures they use, compare them with the graphs from the death books. Sometimes you get really good sound data. For example, Dachau, the camp Dachau, was liberated by the Americans at the end of the war, and they gave total mortality to Nuremberg. It was broken down month by month, and you can see about 5 or 10 people a day dying month by month, and then this peaks, terrible peak at the end of the war. You know, you get 100 or 200 people dying a day, as we've discussed. Now, that is real data. That's real information, and it's raw data, and it's not mythologized. The mythologizing increases things by two orders of magnitude. I indicated you've got something like 40,000 Jews die at Auschwitz. You've got about roughly 40% of the population of the German labor camps were Jews. And that 40,000 goes up to 4 million, which the Soviets report after they liberated Auschwitz. They report 4 million dead.
What's at the base of that? Because from 40,000 to 4 million, I mean, that's two more zeros, right?
Well, the base of it is that everyone believed the Soviets because they liberated Auschwitz. Everyone knew the Soviets had got the data. I mean, that's quite a difficult question to answer. Let me answer it this way, Hendrik. The figure of 6 million has been pulsing through the 20th century and a kind of satanic mantra that kept going the whole bloody time. It started in the 1890s, and it was right at the beginning. It was an American Jewish fundraising ploy. It was 6 million Jews in Europe are in trouble, and the initial 6 million figures were from Russia. Russian Jews are in trouble. Russian Jews are about to this. This might happen to them. Either they're dying or they're in danger or they're being famished. And I've got a whole chapter listening, nearly 200 of these newspaper headlines about 6 million Jews. And then in the 1930s, it shifts over to Germany, Hitler. You've got 6 million Jews in danger because of Hitler. Then finally at Nuremberg, it becomes in the past tense, 6 million Jews have died. Now, there's nothing remotely resembling accounts that gives you that figure. There's nothing remotely like accounting or adding up to give you that figure at Nuremberg. And the figure of 4 million, which the Soviets came out with, obviously fits in very easily to the 6 million figure. 4 million died, the Soviets announced, a preposterous figure, and that is then written on stone at Birkenau, written on stone, and then feeds into the 6 million figure, which becomes a sort of a weird mantra that goes through the 20th century. In fact, it's one of the three components of what you have to believe. To be a good citizen, to be a Holocaust believer, you have to believe three things, okay? One, that there was a German intention to exterminate a particular ethnic group, the Jews. Two, that they did it by a huge cyanide gas chambers. And three, that 6 million were killed. There's no trace whatever of truth in any of those three statements, but the 6 million figure is compulsory.
Right. There was someone did a YouTube video, we can link to it too, but they showed the various times throughout history, all the way back to, was it from the 1800s sometimes, when it picked up in some of the newspapers and started being circulated, 6 million.
Really?
I
never heard that. Oh, right. That's amazing. Now, I only heard it beginning at the end of the 19th century.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Maybe that's what it was exactly. But my point being, it's over a long period of time before the Second World War was this number repeated in a lot of different papers, correct?
Yeah.
So that's kind of, okay, showing then, I guess, there's something else behind it. But I think it was actually Jim Fetzer, your colleague or friend, if I can call him that, that actually brought out another interesting point that I heard, which was allegedly, even in Leviticus, that there was a kind of an ideological background, possibly a religious aspect to this, where the righteous, the chosen, could only return to Israel once this kind of a sacrifice had been made of some kind. Do you know if that's true? I haven't read that particular passage.
Well, Hebrew math didn't have a zero to it, so I'm not clear whether they could count up to 6 million. But there is 600,000 as the total number of Jews come out of Egypt at one point. They do a formidable feat of arithmetic and get 600,000. So at some point in the Old Testament, that arithmetic is done. But I can't comment any further.
Okay, no problem. I was just kind of alluding to this idea that the idea of a Holocaust, a burnt sacrificial victim, right, which it actually means.
Yeah, let's focus on that. That is a fiery term. And if you remember, old-timers will remember the nuclear Holocaust, right? That's a correct meaning, use of the term, because it's something fiery and total. That's the literal meaning of the word Holocaust, right? Total, Holocaust, fiery. How did they get that the tremendous heavy word Holocaust? They got it by original stories, which may strain listeners' credulity, of huge burning pyres of bodies. Okay, you get stories coming out, oh yeah, huge piles of bodies, and somehow the oil in the fat bodies burns. So the stories you get at Nuremberg are really, really bad science. Okay, The idea of bodies are inflammable, that you can have a pile of bodies and light them and they'll burn.
There's a lot of water in bodies. It takes a lot of fuel to burn a human body. Yeah.
It does. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. In fact, there's Eli Wiesel. He's put Night. He's like the Messiah of the Holocaust. Recently reclassified as the world's greatest liar who stole someone's identity and wasn't there and hasn't got a tattoo on his arm. And his book sold 12 million. Night. His book Night has sold 12 million. Okay, so he used all sorts of American Holocaust study courses all over the place. And that has, if you read that, that has no gas chambers, but it has huge piles of burning bodies. Okay, and it has sort of lorry loads of little kids are thrown onto these burning pyres, this sort of thing. So the original hellish images conjured up were that enabled them to use the Holocaust term. And a scoffing unbeliever, if you don't believe that, or if it's difficult for you to believe it, just watch the Schindler film, Schindler's List.
Right, yeah.
The film that describes this and shows these burning pyres.
Now, yeah. And that's, of course, unfortunately, where a lot of people get their information from. There is, of course, a huge academic background to this, as you said, which have largely dismissed a lot of evidence. It seems to then be more kind of deception by omission as opposed to deception by fabrication, at least from the academic world. But then you have an entertainment sector, Hollywood, that have kind of latched onto this and continue to kind of, you know, reimpose the vision into people's heads. And I've noticed, too, in many cases, it's not as much about maybe looking at a movie about the Holocaust as it is about constantly being subjected to the repetition, right? It's like a meme. It's like you can watch you can even watch a nature show. You can watch a documentary, a docu-soap, as we call it, a mockumentary. You can watch a unrelated show on, you know, whatever, on the History Channel Network or whatever, that's not about, you know, World War II or something. But here I've noticed that it's kind of, it's brought up to the surface all the time. It's repeated. And I think that it's this mantra repetition that kind of
makes it. It is strange. Makes it? A friend of mine told me that in British newspapers, that once a week there was a Holocaust story.
Right, exactly. Keep it alive, keep it going all the time.
70 years ago, about once a week it comes up. And why do people want this? Do they need the guilt? It gives an ever-flowing river of guilt, which translates into payment towards Israel and support of Israel. I think we need to try and tell people they're not guilty. It didn't happen. You don't just get out of this guilt.
It's also, of course, about today it's used as guilt towards the West, not only Germany. It's kind of transformed now where all of Europe in some way are supposed to feel guilt that they didn't do more to stop the Holocaust. Am I correct?
Yeah, right. And guilt about the Christian religion.
Yes.
As if that's somehow, if God permits 6 million Jews to be killed for no reason, that is a basis for modern despair and nihilism, I think. That the modern religion of the Holocaust is based on that kind of, that bleak despair, which causes people to give up their hope and belief they did have in a good world or a good God or whatever.
Right. Well, exactly. It really kind of it anchors almost a deity like, you know, Darth Vader or Satan out of the Bible as something that was real and existed on the earth, and he was called Hitler, right? So
yeah. So you get images of ultimate evil, Hitler and Auschwitz, and as you might notice, I don't favour discussions with talking about Hitler because it's so emotional, so heavily demonised. But I do favour discussions about Auschwitz, concrete, physical discussions about what actually happened there and the arithmetic of who lived there and who died there, who passed through. And that seems to me real-world discussion trying to wake up and smell the coffee and accept that it's not the business of historians to find ultimate evil in one particular place and time. That kind of judgment isn't really our business.
Well, I agree with you there in terms of what you're trying to do, of course, with the book as well, because the rest of the story is that's as subjective, it's ideological, it's political, it can be debated, it's what have you. But what you're going for here, which I think it's a good approach to the subject for historical accuracy of trying to get closer to the truth and trying to figure out what really happened, is to look at the science of the matter. Because what has ended up happening here is, just to harken back to the guilt issue for a while, is that I think that as a consequence to this, if it turns out that this is a lie, right, then they've manipulated the most positive aspects of human empathy in the worst kind of horrible way. And that in itself should be viewed as a horrible crime, you know, because as you said, so many things consequently have happened after the Second World War, where we not only, of course, have planned extermination of Germans in the prison camp, like Eisenhower's prison camps, but you have you have bombings of, you know, Dresden and Hamburg, and I think you mentioned, well, how many tons of bombs were dropped on Germany by Americans? I think you had a number on that, didn't you?
Central Europe, 2.5 million. That isn't just Germany. Yeah, mainly Germany.
Okay, 2.5 million tons of bombs. Yeah.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. Yeah. So there's been certain, exaggerations. We can return to the numbers question here a little bit as well, but certain exaggerations that have, as far as I understand the situation, have been retracted or simply dropped, not focused in recent years. For example,
well, I think it's partly,
go ahead.
People wondering, why do we fight the war? What was held, you know, at Nuremberg, why did nobody mention that 2.5 million tons of bombs have been dropped? You know, this self-righteous moral posturing. How come the victors could avoid mentioning that they'd incinerated all these cities? Oh, no, we don't talk about that. So I think the Holocaust is a mythos. Part of its function is to stop British people to having to consider why that war was. Why is Britain a country that always starts wars, since always start wars and normally wins them? And in this case, I don't think with either world war against Germany, it's really faced up to why it did that or what the war was for. And the Holocaust, as it were, prevents you from having to do that. Now, let me ask you something, Hendrik.
Sure.
Can you imagine debate being allowed in Europe? Because that's what puzzles me most of all. I mean, I belong to a truth movement group, right? I love, chat about conspiracy and who's done what, a 9/11 truth group and so on.
Yep.
And they'll say, oh, no, we can't talk about that. Oh, God, no. Oh no, we'll have to chuck you out if you want to talk about that.
Right.
It's partly because of such deep emotions that are involved.
Sure,
websites,
of course.
Say, no, we're not discussing any Holocaust issues, because it's as if people, as it were, go over the top. Now, I personally feel that is catharsis, and it's exactly what we most need. We do need emotional discussion in which abuse and insult is not permitted.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
That we can be passionate and talk about what really happened. Let's have Germans, Jews, different European nations talking about what the hell we think happened.
Exactly.
Who suffered most?
Yeah.
Who and maybe whose fault is for what? And can we please allow a discussion? I just don't get the way we're not allowed to talk about it. It's really strange for me.
It is really amazing, you know, because it by covering it up in the way that they have, it's really just kind of exacerbating the problem, and it's almost also creating this intense division. And I've seen this. I want to make an analogy here to other events in history, where I've seen that they create such rifts in the population. And bear with me here for a moment, but it's like if you take 9/11 for example, those people who begin to investigate it, they realize what a tremendous lie it is. They might not have all the intricacies of exactly how or exactly why or exactly who, but they've researched enough to discover that there's something amiss with the official story. It means either it's a misrepresentation, either they're not telling us all the facts and figures, or what have you. The clear evidence indicates that something is wrong, and we can discover discrepancies in it, right? But when you do that, you create immediately like two different camps, and one camp that has started looking at the evidence, they almost get, they feel so alienated over this very aspect that the other crowd refuses to look at the reality of the situation, because they haven't looked into it usually for themselves. They have only heard the mainstream media version of it. They've heard the theatrical movie version of it, and they're absolutely convinced that it happened. And they're equally upset with you over the aspect that you're even talking about this, that you're not believing it. And the other camp is equally upset about them for refusing to look at the evidence. And voila, we've created this kind of wedge issue, really, which is the truth in this case, where you get polarization, where these different sides refuse to talk with each other, refuse to look at it. And I feel it's the same issue that has occurred here, that it's so charged, it's so emotionally loaded, that to get these camps talking with each other seems like an impossibility at this stage, right?
Yes, it's very strange, isn't it?
Very strange.
I mean, Germany was like the Christian heart of Europe, has a deeply metaphysical and mystical culture, you know, poets, musicians, artists, mystics, and it gets ferociously attacked twice.
That's right.
And now we've got a very empty, commercial, consumerist, warrior-oriented Anglo-American culture dominating Europe instead. And with
cultural erosion, you have multiculturalism, you have all these things that are completely destroying the people of Europe at the moment. You know?
Yeah. Well, that's another thing, that there's one place where I can go to discuss this matter, and that is what's called the right wing or new right meetings, which have to be held in a sort of semi-secret manner, but a large number of people want to come to them. And they're very enthusiastic when it's happening. People looking at cultural identity. Who are we?
Right.
Can we keep our heritage, what it means to be British and so on?
Yeah.
Is that all going to disappear or can we keep it? And this is ethically damned as far right. I don't know what far right means.
I don't know either, yeah.
If you're in favour of your traditional national culture, you're called far right. And there, people do like talking about it.
That's right.
And I can have chats about it, and it's a great relief to me to be able to, something I like talking about.
Without being persecuted for your thought crime opinions, right?
I mean, I would like to see a truth movement that does open up and can handle this business.
I know, I agree.
It seems to me that 70 years after World War II, we ought to be capable of evaluating what happened there.
Yeah.
It's like it's only in Iran. Iran is the one country that makes positive statements about not believing in the Holocaust story. And
look at how they're treated on the international scene, right?
Exactly, yeah. They're threatened with being nuked.
Yep.
Possibly because of that. Faurisson thinks that the threats of war against Iran are primarily because of its skepticism of this sacred Jewish story.
That's right. That's right.
So there is some strange metaphysical angle whereby a sort of dualism that Germany is, as it were, harboring our image of evil. It's taking care of our image of who the bad guys are, so that we can feel that we're the good guys.
Yeah, exactly. And this is now extending itself, as I said, to other European cultures. And I mean, Sweden has been flogging itself for years that they didn't do more to help, you know, attack Germany. And I know that this has extended to other countries as well now. And yeah, so it's a collective guilt that now extends to anybody of European heritage, basically. And it's used as a method to also justify the cultural erosion that we see in the West at the moment.
Yeah, it's a very strange way these things link together, isn't it?
It is, certainly is. Now, I just want to return to one thing before we continue this path, because it's very interesting. I want to get more into what happened to you at the university and what happens when you just begin questioning these things. But the issue of exaggerations that I feel we didn't really close up yet, and I wanted to mention this because I think it's interesting. We have a couple of different things that have been, I guess, retracted or simply just not talked about at all. We do have the numbers question, of course, but beyond that, we have, for example, that it was a story going around that they used to make soap of the prisoners. They used to make
lampshades
exactly, of the prisoners.
But that all faded away. I thought it faded away in the early 90s because they did chemical analysis of these, and any chemical analysis would show that they were pig skin or, you know, from pigs' fat. And so I thought that killed it. But someone told me that on the BBC Holocaust program a few days ago, they brought it back again.
Oh, really? Yeah.
And I can believe it. Yeah, the lampshades, for God's sake.
This was a big fraud. It was testing was done on it. It was a done deal. They said these have been exaggerations. And of course, what people have to question at that point is, wait a minute, if this is not detailed and laid out and presented as being exaggerations, you have to logically follow through and say, okay, well, what else have they lied about then?
What else is untrue? Yeah. If we've been lied about that,
What about the hair of, I heard in other stories that the hair, for example, of the Jewish women was used to fill the pillowcases of German women who liked to sleep on that hair, right?
They did have recycling industries in the camps. They had a lot of hair, which was shaved off for the delousing. Everyone's hair was shaved off. And I believe that ended up in pillowcases. I mean, there was a war going on, you know. The man had a lot of choice in this matter. And shoes, likewise. If you read Primo Levi's account, this be a man, he had to take his shoes off and be given some nasty clogs that he didn't like. It may be... anyway, they ended up with a lot of shoes. So
the shoes is not evidence that people were murdered, that we just issued different clothing and shoes, correct?
As a friend of mine said, we need to think about how logic works in this case. A pile of shoes is a pile of shoes. A pile of shoes does not imply anybody's being, any mass murder program is going on.
Right.
If you've got, you go into a modern Holocaust temple and you see these big piles of shoes. Well, they had recycling industries in the camps and that included shoes. And you did have mortality. You had a lot of people dying in the camps. And the shoes were maybe reused or whatever. It doesn't show anything fiendish that you've got a big pile of shoes in your local Holocaust Memorial Museum. I don't know where they get them from, actually. They've got these temples all around the world where the shoes come from.
Right.
But that is a vital part of any Holocaust Memorial Museum, I believe.
Sure, definitely re-emphasize the points there. Let's talk a little bit more now about the money here and how many people have applied, because obviously we do have, interestingly enough, for being, you know, Germans were known for their efficiency and for their industriousness and everything else, but for some reason we have a tremendous amount of survivors from these so-called death camps.
I think Corazon's argument here is very relevant. He's the great sort of dean of modern revisionism, Robert Forison, and he says all these Holocaust survivor testimonies are actually a refutation of the theme, because there's so many of them. You've got, around the turn of this century, there are about 1 million designated Holocaust survivors, right?
Yep.
That's 60 years on. Now, do the maths. That's going to give you a good 5 million, at least 5 million survivors at the end of the war. If you've got 1 million receiving money from Germany as a Holocaust survivor. It kind of leads to the story. Yes, so of the 4 million Jews in all the lands occupied by the Nazis, 6 million died, and tragically, only 5 million survived after the war.
So the numbers doesn't add up.
The numbers of the alleged Holocaust survivors absolutely refute the idea of an extermination program. It's a self-refuting process that they've now got up to rough something in the order of 6 million people who have claimed from Germany, as we discussed earlier.
Yeah,
that absolutely nullifies their own claim.
Yeah, you're right. Now, is there any number to how much Germany have paid to? I guess there's two different fields here. One is, of course,
I mentioned earlier. It's a good 100 billion Deutschmarks that they have paid out. Yeah,
that's a lot of money. Let me ask you, Nick, has that gone to Israel or personally into the pockets of Holocaust survivors?
Well, that's a good question. What I hear is it goes straight into Israel. That's basically what I hear. Yeah.
All right. Yeah.
And I could mention what Germar Rudolph said to me. He said, from Germany's point of view, it's a good deal. He said it's such a mighty industrial nation that it pays 2 billion a year. And that gives it political peace and stability. It doesn't have to worry. If it didn't pay that, it might be nervous of being picked on, exploited, or God knows what.
Oh, absolutely. So at the root of this, there is a monetary interest to preserve a huge industry that is not interested in getting the potentiality of any discrepancies in the story to come out. That's important for people to understand that there is a monetary gain, much in the same way that you can watch, you know, transnational corporations cover things up because it would be bad for the brand name. You have a similar issue occurring here with the Holocaust industry, correct?
Yeah. I mean, we've got one historian with, I think, integrity who has covered some matter, David Irving, and he became very heavily vilified and damned, and his whole life has suffered by being so much damned. I suspect that his books on the history of World War II will be respected as the best ones around for their integrity, but he stepped out of line, and he would go to all over Europe to get primary sources and check things out very, very carefully, you know. And initially he was highly esteemed. His book on the bombing of Dresden is very highly regarded.
Yeah.
Then he published his book called Hitler's War, and it made no mention of Hitler knowing anything about any Holocaust or extermination of Jews, because he hadn't found any evidence for it. And that was, as it were, the end of his career.
That's right.
Pulped all his books. He can only give talks at secret locations, even now, many years later. You know, you can't announce in advance. That's just the way it is.
Tell us what happened to you then at the university, how people began treating you and the way that you were ousted just for asking the type of questions that we've been talking about today.
Mm. Well, I didn't mention it to my college. People said I was asking for trouble because I put up stuff on a website under my own name, right? I said, I put analyses of these. There were two main chemical investigations, Gerhard Rudolph and Fred Leuchter, and I integrated and compared the two, and I concluded that the gas chambers were hygienic and not homicidal, and, you know, they kill bugs, not Jews. And that was reported to my college, and I was immediately thrown out. I was denounced on the website of the college, and I didn't have any opportunity to discuss anything. Nobody wanted to talk about anything with me. I was simply thrown out, and then immediately the newspapers all picked on me, and a blog started picking on me, it was like I had the mark of Cain branded on my forehead, you know, if I went into my local pub or whatever. Even my partner, she had to take her little daughter out for a week from my home because the stress was too much of what was happening.
Right.
Nobody actually threatened me, you know. I didn't get beat up or anything. This happened to David Cole. I was ethically damned, and I think at least half of my friends couldn't bring themselves to speak to me anymore. And this was the worst thing for me, that people were so shocked by what they read that they weren't sure if they're allowed to speak to me anymore. It took quite a few years to come round, and I had to just not talk about the subject, you know.
Right.
Just... I met a few people, say in America, like Jim Fetzer, who actually were prepared to talk about it. And he said, look, this is an interesting subject. It's important. It's still something that you can't generally talk about. So it was severe trauma for me. The worst thing that ever happened to me, really.
Is the truth worth it, as you see it right now, as a battle that we need to, you know, take on for those who are interested in exposing falsehood and who believe in truth and science and all these kinds of issues? Is it worth to take that battle on?
Well, I didn't have any choice.
Right.
I did what I had to do, it's exactly why I majored in history and philosophy of science, because of to look at controversial things like that. That's what I think science historians should be doing. I mean, I got ethically damned after being various Jews in newspapers were ethically damning me. A few days later, I got ethically damned by a Jew in a prestigious American history of science journal called ISIS. And I'd had a biography published of Isaac Newton in a in a American published astronomy biographical encyclopedia, and he was reviewing this book, and he just went off denouncing me and saying this whole book should be pulped because it had my article in it and it was so terrible. And Jim Fetzer was quite impressed by this. So we wrote to all the members of the American History of Science Committee, the History of Science Society, saying this was not very proper behaviour. Not a single one of them replied. But it's something I think people have sort of got over now. People can able to relate to me without thinking the dreadful, terrible thing I did. But somehow, and some people say that I made it respectable and possible to talk about the subject. That's what some people tell me.
Right, of course.
That they can see the arguments what I put forward, and they're now feeling they're more able to talk about it.
Just to emphasize that point, it's not something you go into just for the sake of it, of creating havoc or that you're interested in having your life destroyed, because you've very well know how other people have been treated that looked at the subject, right? So it's not something you do for because it's fun, right?
Yeah. There was a Bishop Williamson, who was thrown out of his...
SSPX.
SSPX.
The order, exactly.
So me and a friend, we'd go around and see him now and then. We'd talk about what it was he'd done. He made a comment about Fred Leuchter, quite precisely accurate comment, and that terminated his career, and he eventually got thrown out. So that was one person I could talk to. And then around about 2010, I felt that was what I call a turning point. This is a turning of the tide, okay? And I asked first people why this was. Oh, let me say, Hendrik, that I feel if you look at any media reports on the Holocaust now, don't bother to read what they say. Just go to the comments, okay?
Yeah, yeah.
And the comments, nowadays, I think they're mainly angry and sceptical.
Right, yeah.
Okay? Whereas a few years ago, when I was chucked out, 2008, they were nearly all believing it, and they were horrified at anyone for doubting it. Now, I asked people what happened around about 2010. Was this due to me being thrown out or anything? And they say, no, it wasn't that at all. It's what Israel has done in Gaza. People are so sick and tired of what Israel's behaving, that therefore they're not in a mood to believe this sacred myth in the way they used to be.
Right, yeah.
That's what people tell me.
Right.
And I feel that since around about 2010, there has been an irreversible turning of the tide that... and nobody can stop that tide or turn it round again. I think this sacred belief, the Holocaust, they're trying to shore it up. All the media are trying to shore it up, but I think public belief is draining away, and that they can't stop it.
Do you equate the questioning of the victim status that the Jews have concerning the Holocaust as anti-Semitic, or that it equates to hatred of Jews?
Well, I can't see any connection at all, actually. What happened to them in the war, that's got nothing to do with why you should like or dislike somebody because they're Jewish. What I find frightening is the extent to which Jews have internalized this story as if it's part of their sacred identity. And I would advise them not to do so, because I think the dam is about to break, and this belief will fall apart, and people will be angry at having had the wool pulled over their eyes over all these years. So I would advise Jews to follow people like my friend Paul Eisen in this country, a Jewish fellow, and Gilad Atzmon, a Jewish fellow, who are looking at the world without believing in this story, that we're all better off without it. It's a psychotic belief, and it damages our world picture and also our ability to be friendly with each other.
Well, did you ever see the documentary Defamation from 2009? Do you know the film?
I don't think so, no.
Okay, because it showed as well that it's not only, of course, the general population that gets told just one version of the story that we're told. It was actually very indicative of showing how young Jewish teenagers and kids in some cases were actually drawn into believing this as well, that they were very much programmed into thinking that, you know, around every corner in Europe, there's basically a Nazi that's waiting there standing to kill you. It developed a tremendous polarization between kind of a them or us and them, kind of.
Yeah. So
it's like they're mind controlling their own. That's my point here.
Yeah, they are. And the word Nazi is almost the same as Zion Nazi, just rearrange the letters. And the ideology of the National Socialism in the 1930s was basically almost identical with that of Zionism, of a special chosen race, and of some kind of supremacy and of military adventure. It's a very similar or maybe identical ideology. So I think Jews talking about Zionism in Israel need to realize this, that it is very much the shadow side of their own belief. And it's a projection that they use to defend themselves.
Now, let me ask you, so what do you think is going to happen here if it becomes more widely known that this is built on a lie, that people discover in some capacity, or it becomes more widely known that, wait a minute, something is wrong here. Is this going to make because you refer to this as a kind of a new religion almost, there have, temples to it all around the world.
Yeah.
Is this something that's going to, crumble? Is there going to be a lot of anger expressed here? I mean, does Germany have a claim back?
Well, just think of the unreality and untruth that our civilization is built on with 9/11. Politicians want to manipulate you, and to manipulate you, they want to induce fear. It's horrible. They can't give you hope anymore. They just give you fear. This Holocaust mythos is used by politicians for frightening and intimidating people and coercing them into agreeing to the next war. Without it, we could maybe start to think about how to be happy. And actually, we're here to enjoy life. Can we please banish this nightmare hallucination? Decide to forgive ourselves, mutual forgiveness. European nations, we forgive ourselves for creating this nightmare. Decide to get on with a happy future without it.
Right, yeah.
I mean, that's why we need a European forum of reconciliation and forgiveness in which people do not have false motives ascribed to them, as we said earlier. That is what I sort of supremely believe is necessary. And the powers that be always want to shut it down. They always give you these false epithets. Oh, that means you're an admirer of Hitler. Oh, you're a white supremacist. All this crap.
Yeah.
They always project onto you if you try and talk about it.
Yeah, because it seems, you alluded to this before, but it's like, it's almost no serious debate is ever allowed to occur on the subject, because I think that the counter arguments here would be so powerful that it would get people thinking. So instead of actually trying to appeal and debunk those from the official point of view, they simply just, as you said, they kind of just sling labels on people, and then they kind of move on without touching any of the actual arguments at hand. Correct.
Correct. Yeah. Yeah. And let me say, I'm quite happy to debate the subject anywhere. If anyone wants to invite me to talk about it. I think we need a mentality of, as it were, being harmless. We do not have the will to cause harm to others, because a lot of the European legislation prohibiting this stuff involves the concept of that you might disturb the public peace. There's no reason to believe this disturbs the public peace. It just means you have a good discussion, and you're not inciting hatred. You're resolving enigmas of the past. Because a lot of the European legislation banning Holocaust denial is of that form, that it would induce public disturbance, or it would project hate on a particular group. There's no need for that to happen.
I don't understand that, because wouldn't it be a positive aspect if it turns out that fewer people actually died?
Absolutely, yeah. And the claim that you are projecting hate again. Well, if you look at the French law, Gaisot law, it's only used by Jews prosecuting white male Frenchmen.
Yeah.
So it's always used in that context, and the allegation of hate being induced is made by the person prosecuting. I think they should have to give evidence. They should have to summon a psychologist. Any crime that based on an emotion or accusation, you should have a psychologist summoned to testify that emotion is generated. I think no legislation should exist based on emotion. Okay.
Yeah.
Our legislation should be based on crime, which is a deed that's been done. But if you have got your Holocaust laws are based on alleged hate that's being generated, just like we've got anti-terror laws. And if people do want those laws to exist, then a psychologist needs to be summoned to give evidence whether that emotion has been activated.
Yeah, exactly. And well, it's a victimless, I wouldn't classify it as a crime because it isn't. It's just questioning history, but it's victimless nonetheless. It doesn't imply anything. It doesn't direct hatred towards anybody. It's just questioning history.
Yeah, and let me ask you, Hendrik, I'm wondering whether you've come across any debate anywhere in Europe where people could actually meet and debate this subject. Because in England, the last public debate attempted was when David Irving, about 15 years ago, invited Fred Leuchter over, and he was on Chelsea Town Hall, and he was about to start the talk, and then the police arrested him and hustled him off back to America on the request of the Board of British Jews.
Yeah.
That was the nearest we had to a public debate. At least David Irving tried. I don't think there's been any since, unless me getting a little huddled group talking about it.
I've not seen it. It's very unfortunate. I mean, it's amazing when you think about it, because I mean, as it currently stands, it's one of the most important historical events of modern history. Right. Yeah. And I mean, that's the weight of it, the importance of it, the aspect, you know, never again and all these kinds of issues that there's, you know, claim or say, then you think especially that this would be the thing that would debated. But it's not. It's quite the opposite. So
quite the opposite. Yeah.
Very, very curious how that is. Now, let me ask you about the media here, then, because we have a constant repetition of the same story. We have an entertainment industry where I'd say the majority of people get their world opinions from, unfortunately. They don't get it from large academic tomes of world history, and they don't read a lot of books anymore or anything like that. They go watch movies and TV shows and stuff like that, and here's where it's repeated.
Well, as John Lash said in a recent interview with you, films could potentially be a very valuable mode of conveying historical truth.
Absolutely.
It was used properly.
Yeah.
There's no reason why they should give this consistently misleading view of history, or one could imagine it being otherwise, you know.
Yeah, definitely. And so the question there was, how do you think, you know, media should be counteracted here? Because of course we have people like yourself, many others, they're writing books, they're talking about this, they're interested in history and trying to get the message out, but Is it enough to reach through and appeal to people to begin to investigate it for themselves? So how do we do that? How do we reach out and get people interested in this portion of history?
Well, that's the big question, yeah. In this country, the media, say anything that you'd call conspiracy theory, sort of off the away from what is allowed, they will be allowed to report something as if a conspiracy theorist, so-called, in some way becomes publicly visible. If you're out or cause you a bit of disturbance or you're a bit charismatic or you're seen to be influencing people, then one or two newspapers will report and they will describe your view as that of a conspiracy theorist. And they might have described it with some sympathy, but in the end they have to sort of give some dismissive comment, you know. So I think we only have truth on the web these days. Which is a very strange situation. That the web is uncensored, and there's no printed media that That's, I'll tell you, the only printed media I can imagine might possibly review my book is one in Australia called Nexus.
Sure.
Offbeat.
Yeah.
You know.
But that's kind of not, that's not mainstream though, is it? That's more of an alternative paper. So, yeah. So I get the point there. They're obviously, you know, attacking the people who talk about these things. They try to prove that you're a nutcase or, you know, whatever, if you gain some kind of, if you have come with credibility or if you so they oust you pretty quick. But my point here has been that if these issues are based on lies, if it's true that the media are not looking at the real stories, they're just mouthpieces for, you know, intelligence services and governments, etc., it's something that is not going to last in the long run. And I think we're seeing the initial steps of this now, when a lot of mainstream media outlets are actually losing credibility. People are turning away from them. They're going to the web to get the real stories. It's kind of like whatever they do in this case, the lie is not going to stand forever. It's just not going to work.
Well, we thought not. No, and it's a spiritual issue here. Do you want to live your life in the light of truth? Do you want your words to have integrity to them? Or do you just want to repeat what journalists and films give you?
I
think maybe bishops, a priest should be concerned about this. But I can't quite see what will happen. I feel that something's about to happen, just because I find people are much more amenable and sympathetic to this theme, and it can be talked about, whereas it couldn't some years ago.
Right.
That's all I can say, is I feel there's some change coming.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think I think that the cost for those that have been trying to lie about these things is going to be quite big, and that would be the media, and of course in the way that this story has been, you know, fabricated. And again, I think the anger that when and if it's discovered, I kind of see it as the fall of the Soviet Union, almost, with the Samizdat, the press, you know, the small outlets that were basically leading to the kind of ideological downfall from within of the Soviet Union, you know, and it's kind of much the same way here, that the whole big media empire will crumble as more and more people kind of they completely lose credibility in their eyes, you know. So I'm hoping for that.
Yeah, that sounds good. Yeah. Now, in Sweden, where my grandfather came from, is there any kind of discussion, or do people want to look at this side of things at all? Is there anything revisionist at all?
Under the radar, there probably is quite a bit too. I'm not too well versed in savvy if there's a lot of people or a lot of groups looking into it, or in what capacity they're doing that. But I think it's even worse in Sweden. Actually, it's on in such a level that you get violence exhibited to those people who question these kinds of things. We've had several, you know, people stabbed by violent left wing groups in Sweden and things like that. So it's a very taboo subject, I'd say, and there is an anger that more people are not, you know, interested in it in the official version, and believe the official version or are attributed to dedicating their entire lives to continue to spread the lies about the official version. But no, there's not much activity at all, as far as I'm concerned. Never in the media, never in the press. It's very most of the media is state subsidized anyway. It's very controlled, and it's all left-wing people all over the place, and journalists and reporters are very, very not diverse in their political leanings, I should say. So no, unfortunately not.
Oh, shucks.
Now let's see if there's anything else here we want to get out before we start wrapping up for this time, Nick.
Yeah.
Because again, it's a huge subject. There's so many different components to it. There's so many different things to the subject, and it's not something we're going to solve in a 2-hour interview. There's going to be countless of things that could be discussed and should be discussed surrounding this area. But is there anything that you feel is important we should mention before we wrap things up? Perhaps you would want to say something to, let's say, those who continue to listen and haven't gotten too angry and just turned off, that still are in denial or still don't believe what you're bringing to the table. What would you say to those people to encourage them to look at this for themselves?
Well, I guess that it's a question of what we're living for. What are we here on Earth for? And Britain and America we've got a dominant British American culture which always goes to war. And this is a war ratifying illusion that the Holocaust. That the most sacred myths of our culture are war ratifying illusions. The 9/11 event and the Holocaust mythos. We need to find some way of living that's a more sort of gentle and balanced, and in which we do not have a psychological need for this horror image. It's as if people, if their own lives have some sort of bleak despair in them, and therefore they tune into the Holocaust thing. Oh yeah, very clever German, brilliant German science. No wonder they could gas 6 million Jews by technology no one's ever seen. That kind of despair image, I think it's sinful to allow yourself that kind of despair image, and not challenge yourself to look for the evidence. If you just switch on the media and it gives you this, reinforces you this thing about, oh, how terrible what we did to God's chosen people, that is not going to give you a future that's worth living in. It would give you a future that will keep getting worse. I mean, that is the effect. This Holocaust mythos is working very strongly in our culture, and it always justifies changes that make things worse. It's not something that will bring hope to our culture.
I agree. Very well said.
I think that's the way I put it.
Yeah. Very good. Very good. All right. So the book here that we've been talking about, ladies and gentlemen, is called Breaking the Spell, The Holocaust Myth and Reality. And of course, you can get it on Amazon.com. There's other website or Amazon.co.uk. The British version of Amazon will have some links up to the book if you want to read more. Also, check out some of the work that Nick has done on the London 7/7 bombings, by the way, as well. And you can find more on the website that he has for that called terrorontheTube.co.uk. And then, of course, you have also whatreallyhappened.info. And is there anything else you want to tell us about that website of what people can find there? It's not only yours, it's a group of people, right?
Yeah, it's a group of us, and we're trying to just get it censored, I think, on the British intelligence decrypts, but there's some other essays there as well, yeah.
All right, very good. Well, keep up the good work, Nick, and we'd love to have you back again in the future. There's more components to this we could and should talk about as well, but in the meantime, we say thank you so much for coming on. We really appreciate your time today.
It's been a great honor to be part of your Red Ice creation, Hendrik. Yeah.